Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Donald Trump's transition team has written a memo outlining his plan for the first 200 days of his presidency. One major area of focus for Trump will be to start renegotiating trade deals from his first day in the White House, especially NAFTA, but also new rules between U.S. and China. We'll see what happens there. President Obama arrived in Greece yesterday on his final overseas trip before Donald Trump takes office in January. What is his real agenda? The resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline continues as a day of action saw more than 200 protests across the country. Is this part of a new wave of protests in the United States? But first, we turn to the memo on Trump's first 200 days in office. We are joined from Connecticut by Vijay Prashad. He is the George and Martha Kellner Chair in the South Asian History and Professor of International Studies at Trinity College. His latest book is Death of the Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution. Welcome back, Vijay.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks. Nice to be with you.
Thanks. The short list for Trump's cabinet keeps getting shorter by the hour as people are being pushed out or step aside. But we want to talk about the memorandum that was revealed in the media yesterday. Let's look at the transition memo from the Trump team, the first 200 days. What does it consist of?
Well, it's interesting. There's, let's say, two major points that I think should be picked up and discussed. One is that he lays out, or his team lays out, an agenda for withdrawal from NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. And the assumption is that within about 200 days, that is under a year, the United States would leave NAFTA. This is essentially a Brexit vote, you know, for the United States. The second thing in this memo, which I think bears some discussion, is that he promises to slap a tariff on Chinese-made goods between 35% and 45% tariff. Now, that's a really stiff tariff, an interesting development from the Trump campaign. Goes after what he has talked about for a while now, which is against what he considers to be a rigged trade system set up by the globalists. So essentially, exit from NAFTA and a very large a trade wall against China.
A trade tariff against China will have to create a situation in which China takes countermeasures. You know, I was looking at China Daily newspaper this morning, as I do every morning, the U.S. version, and Xi Jinping is quoted as welcoming Trump's call to Xi Jinping. It's their talk about the need for mutual respect, and Trump said all of the right things, things that the Chinese certainly would want to hear. He said that they were a great success, et cetera, et cetera. But that's Trump's sort of MO, which is to start nice and then really later reveal the true program. If China has huge tariffs employed against it, it would seem to be not only something that China would have to counter, but it would be very detrimental once China does counter it, does take countermeasures, to American businesses and American financial institutions, the biggest banks that are also very interested in opening up the Chinese market.
Well, look, you know, Brian, you're exactly correct in what you say, and I'll come to that in a minute. But I think the first thing that people need to pay attention to is that Mr. Trump is taking us on an experiment at a scale we've never seen before. In other words, much smaller countries with much less position in the world economy have exited from the system. And most of them, of course, have faced extreme turmoil when they exited in the way they did, whether it's voluntarily or not. You know, in a sense, Iran involuntarily was thrown out of the international financial system during the sanctions period. And one was able to look and see how Iran bore the pressure of being ejected from the world financial system. But the United States is the buyer of last resort. You know, this major economic powerhouse at the center of the world economy. And so we've never seen an exit at the scale of the United States. You know, there was almost hyperventilation when Britain voted to exit from the European Union. But that's really nothing compared to the United States effectively walking away from NAFTA and from its trade relationship with China. This is at a much greater scale, and we really don't know what would happen. You know, the expectation by Mr. Trump is that a large tariff wall against China would somehow itself spur job creation in the United States. You know, this brings us back to Alexander Hamilton and his very important document from the 18th century, the Report on Manufactures. You know, the early period of economic nationalism, this idea of using tariffs and subsidies to protect an economy. I mean, I can understand the intellectual roots of this, but certainly there will not only be economic manifestations. In other words, I don't know if it's going to work that this will create jobs, but the political manifestations which you alluded to are going to be very severe. I mean, imagine, China is not going to take a 45% tariff wall lightly. It will immediately say, we're not going to buy from Boeing any longer. We'll buy our big planes from Airbus. It might say, we're not interested in buying heavy machinery from the United States. It might say that we'll seek other markets for our products, for instance, the Russian market or the African market, or indeed the domestic Chinese market, where there's a great deal of pent-up demand. So the political ramifications of such a high tariff are going to be quite severe, and it might end up, of course, isolating the United States from the rest of the world.
When the United States entered the imperial scramble with the beginning of the Spanish-American War, so-called, in 1898 and 1899, and then the invasion of the Philippines in 1899 and the move towards Asia, the Secretary of State at that time, Hayes, proclaimed the open door notes, in other words, the policy whereby spheres of influence or colonial possessions shouldn't be the last word in terms of trade, that those who could produce commodities or export capital at a better rate could beat out their competition, meaning the United States wanted to break up the old colonial spheres of influence because it didn't have a big sphere of influence, except perhaps in Latin America. And since that time, for the most part, the U.S. has been on that course. And certainly there was an isolationist wing of the Republican Party that was pretty much vanquished at the start of World War II. And then after World War II, where the U.S. assumed the role that British Empire had assumed earlier and became the dominant world capitalist power, at least, free trade, so-called, was certainly in the interest of the expansion of U.S. corporate and especially industrial manufacturers, because they were producing commodities and goods at a lower price. The value was at a lower value because of the technology that the U.S. was able to apply. What would be the impact now? I mean, if you can try to speculate, and I hear what you're saying, that it's breathtaking in scope.
Well, you know, I'm just going to put some more scale on the table. Across the U.S.-Mexico border, every day, there's about $11 billion of goods transacting. You know, it's incredible, just the scale. Now, you're quite correct that free trade as a nostrum, as a policy as well, was something that big business benefited from because it had a so-called comparative advantage against the economies in the rest of the world. From the 1970s, when there was a beginning of stagnation, relative stagnation in the north, in the United States, in Europe, in Germany, East, West Germany in particular, there was a real interest in shifting the mode of accumulation on a global scale. And it's from that period that this doctrine or this policy of neoliberalism comes into play, which in manufacturing essentially was the way in which the global commodity chain was produced. In other words, because of technological improvements, you know, container ships, better communications, etc., manufacturing capital was able to break up factories, not have them as these large, densely concentrated, you know, giant factories where labor was also concentrated and therefore able to bargain up their position, bargain for wages and for rights, but to break up a factory, spread it across the globe, make it very hard for labor, you know, to have any kind of bargaining position. So this global commodity chain was the outcome of a global neoliberal, you know, worldview. And it's because of this that trade agreements were so necessary to protect these global commodity chains, to create intellectual property rights, to protect the stake that global capital had in this vast manufacturing, you know, kind of networks that existed across the planet. So I understand that the, you know, inequality that one sees in parts of so-called forgotten America are a precise, you know, a result of this global commodity chain, of the move of manufacturing jobs to other countries. The problem is you can't solve this merely at the border, you know, merely by putting up tariff walls. And the reason is that you've disarticulated production, you've broken factories up, put them all around the world. You know, you've got hemorrhaging of talent. People who used to work in factories, used to, you know, have those skills go generation to generation. Talent has now hemorrhaged. It's going to be very difficult to transform what has essentially become a large factory desert, you know, in parts of the Rust Belt, into a vibrant industrial zone again. So you need to have that in mind. Second thing you need to have in mind is you can't change these things at the border because you're not going to come directly at who is most powerful in this system and who's gaining the most, which is these nodes of very large corporations, these sections of this global 1%, etc. You're not challenging their power at all. And if they feel that their accumulation, you know, is being at all threatened, they're going to come at you. Now, I think that you're going to get from Mr. Trump a great deal of rhetoric about going after the globalists, but I think he is well connected enough to know that he's going to have to tack as close as possible to power, but not really threaten its interests. It's very unlikely that any of the policies he's going to produce will actually address deep questions of frustration and unemployment, not only in the United States, but in other parts of the world. This is going to be a huge social experiment that we'll see, but I very much doubt, because he's not going to threaten the people who control money and property, I don't think this is going to have good effects for the millions of people who have been looking to him for some kind of leadership.
I hear you on that, and I think that it makes perfect sense. Certainly, there's no break from the concept of the essential foundation of this particular economic order, which, of course, puts profit first, puts maximizing profit as a very top premium, and also puts the biggest banks in charge of where investment and how trade takes place. That's why I wonder, Vijay, whether you think, outside of the fact that it's not going to bring relief to the people who voted for Trump and who want change, and many of them were in Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania, in those areas in Western New York, where I come from, which is also hollowed out. I come from Rochester, New York, which at one time had 50,000 workers for Eastman Kodak and Xerox and IBM. All of that's gone. Instead, it's like the murder capital of Western New York now. I mean, these areas are suffering. These people are not going to get relief. But the question I'm asking is the elites themselves, those who have been in charge from and benefited from these globalist policies, especially the biggest banks. I mean, what will they do to Trump? I mean, what's going to be their reaction to Trump? And is Trump just flying by the seat of his pants, or does he have some backing from within the ruling class establishment?
Well, I think it's a mixture of all of that, Brian. I don't think that the entirety of the ruling class is backing him. Yesterday on Fox News, Steve Forbes, former presidential candidate, you know, one of the heirs of the Forbes fortune, was very much excited by the Trump presidency. And what interested Mr. Forbes, who, you know, is a dyed-in-the-wool free trader and is opposed to, you know, this idea that we leave NAFTA, the United States leave NAFTA, but at the same time very excited by the Trump candidacy, because he believes what Mr. Trump will actually do is slice or roll back on Obama's regulatory apparatus. You know, all the regulations that they claim came during the Obama years are going to be put back. He believes that the Federal Reserve is going to get its fetters taken off. It's going to stop, you know, challenging finance. Again, you know, the bizarre thing about this, Brian, is that I don't think there were enough regulations in many respects. I don't think the Fed actually did enough to control the way in which, you know, the markets were operating. Nonetheless, Mr. Forbes believes that it was too onerous, and all that will go. In other words, It's going to be pure deregulation. You know, he looked back at the time when Ronald Reagan came to power, and one of the first things Reagan did was deregulate prices of energy. And at the time, yes, there was some concern that if energy prices were deregulated, they'll all go up. And for a very brief time, actually, they went down. Of course, energy prices are not entirely controlled by the Price Control Committee in Washington, D.C., but that's a separate issue. So I think that there's a section of the ruling elite who see in Trump their salvation from Dodd-Frank, their salvation from control of various aspects of their business enterprises. And I think that's where they are going to push him to put his energy. You know, remove the training wheels, let's go and ride as fast as we can. I mean, they believe in the so-called animal spirits of capitalism, but as long as they win at the end, you know, that's the way they like to imagine themselves as great pioneers. As long as, of course, there's a safety net to catch them when they fail.
And that, in fact, exists because it's called the U.S. government, as we saw in 2007, 2008. Vijay, we only have 2 minutes left. I want to ask you about China. The United States, of course, once China opened up in the late 1970s and especially in the 1980s and 1990s, it became a source of sort of capital expansion for the West. In other words, wherever markets have been saturated, now they were able to be expanded because this big part of the globe opened up. Should the Trump administration go ahead with this tariff wall in China? China has the capacity, because it still is ruled by the Communist Party of China, to change direction. In other words, it can make governmental decisions about how investment is directed and where to go. And also, in general, in terms of its foreign policy, do you see, and I see that the Chinese Communist Party just says, let's call each other comrade now instead of boss or CEO or whatever. In other words, there's a possibility for some sort of retrenchment. Talk about in our last, I've used 60 of your 120 seconds. So in the last minute, where do you think it's going to go with China?
Look, it's very simple. On this, I don't think the United States will find many allies. There'll be no European allies. Certainly India and Russia will not ally with the United States to put pressure on China. What's most likely going to happen is those ties that have been building between Russia and China will deepen, that the Europeans have reassessed already this idea of isolating themselves from Eurasia. Those ties are going to deepen. And I think what has been happening already, which is the gradual decline of U.S. power, is going to continue. I think Trump is not going to be able to revive or make America great again. He is going to be the second round of a president after Obama, you know, basically presiding over the decline of American fortunes.
Yeah, very good. We've been talking with Vijay Prashad. He's in Connecticut. He is the George and Martha Kellner Chair in South Asian History and Professor of International Studies at Trinity College. Check out his latest book, The Death of the Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. And Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. President Obama arrived in Greece yesterday on his final overseas trip before Donald Trump takes office in January. As Obama scrambles to explain the election of Trump, he will also be seeking, according to the U.S. media, mainstream media, to reassure Europe and the NATO elites of the enduring bonds between them and the United States. We are joined by Sputnik international political analyst Dmitry Babich. Welcome back, Dmitry.
Yes, nice to hear from you.
President Obama arrived in Athens yesterday. Riot police fired tear gas as thousands of protesters took to the streets. This is the first leg of his last scheduled trip abroad. He'll also travel to Germany and then on to Peru. A part of this visit, according to the media here, is to reassure Europe about ties between the U.S. and NATO ahead of the Donald Trump becoming president. What are the main issues in the trip to Greece and to Europe?
Well, I think that Obama is coming to reassure the European elite. He is not coming to reassure the European voters. And I think the choice of Athens as the beginning of his tour is simply wrong, because Greece still owes to its debtors 320 billion euros. Just imagine what a huge sum that is. That is 180% of the GDP of the country, Greece. So all of that huge debt was accumulated during George Bush the Jr. and during the early years of Obama. the problem is not being resolved. So Mr. Obama may be popular with the officials in the European Union, but he is not popular with the Greek people. And that's why we had this demonstration with 4,000 people going on strike in Athens because of Obama's visit.
I hear you. President Obama, according to some media accounts and some analysts, is part of the trip is to tell the Greek prime minister in Athens that he should refrain from allowing Russian warships to enter Greek ports and to vote to uphold anti-Russian sanctions during his visit to Europe. Of course, the Greek government is part of NATO, it's part of the EU, but it's also maintained friendly or certainly more friendly relations with Russia. Talk about whether that is in fact part of the Obama agenda in Greece.
Well, yesterday, Mr. Obama pressured the Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras to adopt the anti-Russian sanctions and to maintain them in sign of so-called solidarity inside the European Union. And Tsipras said he would keep the sanctions. But that decision is certainly not popular in Greece because the Greek people, like many people in Europe, they don't see what the goal of these sanctions is. You know, does Obama want Russia just to abandon Crimea, to give it back to the Ukrainian regime in Kyiv? That's not going to happen. Everyone understands it. And the other unpopular decision by Obama is to pressure Germany into continuing its rearmament, into making the military expenditures exceed the 2% GDP threshold that is a requirement for NATO members. These are decisions which may be with the elite of the European Union, but they're not popular with the voters in the European countries, in Greece and in Germany. In both of these countries, these are not popular decisions.
Right. And of course, you have in the case of the Greek people, that's not exactly, no matter what, a primary concern. I mean, you have the EU countries who are also the European leaders of NATO having imposed these draconian austerity measures, sanctions of a different type, I would say, on the entire Greek economy and on the Greek people so that German banks and French banks and London banks can be repaid some of the debt, some of the staggering debt that Greece has taken up over the last years and which cannot be paid back now, not necessarily because something's wrong with Greece, although it's undoubtedly has many problems, but because the 2007-2008 recession torpedoed the world economy, and especially poorer countries, countries in the global south or countries in southern Europe really suffered the brunt of that.
You are absolutely right, because if you look at the dynamics of the Greek debt, it was accumulated in the early 2000s, and Mr. Obama did not find a solution to that problem because Greece just kept restructuring its debt, paying huge amounts of money to the German and to the American banks, but never lowering that debt. The debt stays at the staggering level of 320 billion euros. This is unheard of for Greece, you know. And Obama did not find the right words for the Greeks. He kept talking about a certain economic success of Greece. He kept talking about the positive role of the European Union and of the United States in the Greek economy. And very few Greeks believe it. You know, most of the Greeks are very anti-EU, especially after the EU imposed all kinds of draconian measures on Greece. You know, the Greek government cannot decide how to spend its own budget because of the restrictions imposed by the EU.
Right. Writing in the Observer newspaper after Donald Trump's election, Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO, said, "We face the greatest challenges to our security in a generation. This is no time to question the value of the partnership between Europe and the United States." Donald Trump didn't actually question the partnership. He said a few other things, but not the essential element of the NATO alliance, which the U.S. has led since the late 1940s. But then I'm going to continue with Stoltenberg. "For 67 years, this partnership has been the bedrock of peace, freedom, and prosperity in Europe. It enabled us successfully to deter the Soviet Union and bring the Cold War to an end. And it has made it possible the integration of Europe and laid the foundation for the unprecedented peace and prosperity we enjoy today. European leaders have always understood that when it comes to security, going it alone is not an option. Now, there's a lot in that speech. I mean, the wonderful peace and prosperity, as you mentioned, Dmitry, it's maybe enjoyed by the elites. It's certainly not enjoyed by the Greek people. It's not enjoyed by vast parts, perhaps the majority part of the European working class population. And in terms of peace and prosperity, hasn't it been NATO and NATO's policies in the past years that have really ramped up the possibility of a global or certainly a regional conflagration?
I agree with you. Look at the recent actions undertaken by NATO. Was Libya a success? No. Libya is shambles now. Was Ukraine a success? No. Because of Mr. Obama's support for the coup in Kiev, actually the threat of a nuclear war between Russia and the United States, Russia and NATO, was revived. So NATO is no longer making Europeans more secure. There is a strong suspicion that NATO is making Europeans less secure. And a lot of voters feel it. And that's why a lot of Americans voted for Mr. Trump, despite all the threats that Trump was inexperienced. I mean, I think these voters just figured out who Obama was. I mean, what was the value of his experience? Mr. Obama revived the threat of a nuclear war. He made Libya and Syria devastated states, not flourishing democracies, as he promised in the beginning. So a lot of Europeans and Americans are starting to question, do we need this sort of NATO? Does it make us more secure?
Right. Certainly, in terms of the European, and in terms of the American electorate, the people in Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania, those swing states who voted ultimately in their state for Trump, they may not have been thinking much about international relations. They're probably thinking more about their own sort of sorry lot because whole communities, factories have been hollowed out as a consequence of capital globalization. But you're certainly right that people in the United States who are paying attention to international affairs realize that the policies in the last few years, the policies of ramping up confrontation with Russia, of now endless military exercises on Russia's border, or building the so-called missile defense shield in Poland or Romania, all of those are contributing to a greater danger, not a lessening of danger. It doesn't bring more security. It makes people more insecure. But I want to ask you what you think Donald Trump would actually do. Trump said when he was clarifying about his position on NATO, he said, I'm not for ditching NATO. I'm not for breaking up NATO. I'm not for leaving NATO. I want the European countries to pay their fair share of NATO's budget. In other words, the requirement to pay at least 2% of their GDP. I mean, do you think that Trump is actually making some sort of profound sort of shift in U.S. foreign policy regarding NATO, or is some of this sort of uncertain at this point?
Well, I think we will see, depending on whom Mr. Trump appoints as the key figures in his cabinet, who will be the Secretary of State, who will be, you know, the vice heading the other departments of the American government. It's still too early to tell. What we know is that Mr. Obama right now is doing everything to make peace in Europe impossible. I mean, his meeting with the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who was the most aggressive critic of Russia in the European Union, I think that's a very clear message that Mr. Obama wants to send before leaving his office. He wants the confrontation in Europe to continue. He wants to do what he calls shaking the Russian ambition, even though there is no Russian ambition in Europe. We just want to have our own security. We don't want to attack other countries. So with Mr. Trump, we at least have some hope. With Mr. Obama, we have no change.
Yeah, I understand. I understand how people in Russia feel about that, because people there, have to feel, with the escalating tensions and not really initiated by Russia, that the current policy under Obama, or when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, or when John Kerry was Secretary of State, and certainly during the Democratic Party national campaign, where Clinton made Russia a number one punching bag and scapegoat for all things, it certainly is very, it sounds the alarm that something, all of this hyped up rhetoric can be followed by actual actions, or that one side climbs the escalation ladder and then the other side has to climb the escalation ladder. And that's, in fact, how conflicts happen. I want to ask you, in terms of where you think the Greek government will land on all of this, Greece is a small country. It's indebted. It couldn't stand up to the troika in the EU when it voted against austerity. The current government, including the prime minister, essentially had to back down. They're in a tough spot, and yet they still want to retain and maintain and sustain friendly relations with Russia. Where will they go?
Well, answering your question, I would say that I think Obama will fail with Greece, just like he failed with all of his major international initiatives. Look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It is actually dead. You know, the United States government is no longer suggesting it to the American Congress. The Trade and Investment Partnership for Europe, Transatlantic Partnership, TTIP, is also dead because the European governments oppose it, especially the government of France. So basically, I don't expect Obama to be any more successful in Greece. The Greek Prime Minister, Alexis Tsipras, he's not going to tell now Mr. Obama that he is going to leave the sanctions regime against Russia. But Tsipras will do it the first opportunity because Russia is popular in Greece. Greeks hope much more on Russian investment and Russian loans than on honest loans from the European Union. Greece became bankrupt, actually, because of the loans from the European Union, especially from the German banks.
According to Greek officials, we have about a little less than 2 minutes. According to Greek officials, U.S. Treasury Secretary Jacob Lew told Mr. Tsipras during a visit to Athens in July that the U.S. would like Greece's debt relief issue to be resolved before the end of its term, meaning before January 20th, 2017. Greece is hopeful that Obama can put pressure on German Chancellor Merkel to offer substantial debt relief to Greece. Do you think that's going to happen? And what accounts for Obama taking this position that, at least on the face of it, seems sympathetic to Greece's position?
I simply don't believe it will happen because Greece owes the European Union and particularly Germany, Greece owes 320 billion euros. There is no way Mrs. Merkel is going to write off this debt, even if Mr. Obama tells her a lot of nice words. So the Greek financial problem will not be resolved in the next few years, and it's simply technically impossible to resolve it in the next few months. I think it's just a last desperate attempt by Mr. Obama to look like a person who resolved at least one international issue while in office. I'm afraid it's going to be a failure.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been joined from Moscow by Sputnik International political analyst Dmitry Babich talking about President Obama's trip to Greece. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline continues as a day of action saw more than 200 protests across the country Tuesday. Is this part of a new wave of mass protests in the United States? We are joined from the Standing Rock Camp by Candy Mossett, the Indigenous Environmental Network's lead organizer on the Extreme Energy and Just Transition Campaign, who is part of the fight against this pipeline. Welcome, Candy.
Hello, thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. More than 200 rallies against the Dakota Access Pipeline took place across the country yesterday. Tell us about the day of action and what organizers hope to accomplish.
Well, first of all, it was beautiful. It was really heartwarming to be able to see so many people. All 50 states joined in for a successful day of action, you know, across the country to reach out to the Army Corps of Engineer offices around the country and disrupt business as usual and tell them, you know, we do not want the easement. We do not want to bore underneath the Missouri River. But more important than that, we need a full environmental impact statement on this over 1,100-mile long pipeline project. And they should, in fact, be looking at rescinding any of the permits that were given under the Nationwide Permit 12, which is usually only used for any kind of project less than 1 acre in size. So the Army Corps of Engineers has all the power and all the authority to help, you know, do these things, to call for a full environmental impact statement and to rescind permits, not only to protect us here in North Dakota and the Missouri River, but also the Mississippi River, you know, everything that's happening across the four states of North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Illinois.
Let's help the audience, maybe the audience that's not paying as careful attention to what the struggle is all about. Let them understand the big picture. What is the Dakota Access Pipeline? You have, of course, indigenous people from the area who are protesting. You have environmentalists who are protesting. You have people who are against corporate greed, people who want to just protect the planet. Just talk about what's going on and what the struggle's all about.
The struggle is all about the continued narrative that Native people have had for over 500 years, which is that capitalism is not sustainable. And this is one example of how we are again being targeted and impacted by the fossil fuel industry and really not getting any of the energy or any of the things that people might be thinking that would be good that might come out of a fossil fuel resource like the oil industry, but just getting all of the negative impacts, the toxicity and the poisoning of our river and water systems. The Dakota Access Pipeline is oil that's being dug up out of the Bakken oil shale formation, which is predominantly in North Dakota, but also Montana, a little bit into Canada. And in the Bakken shale oil boom, what they're doing is they're fracking. They're using the process of hydraulic fracturing. And the unfortunate thing, one of the unfortunate things, is that the natural gas is just a byproduct of the industry in North Dakota. So what we see is flares, many, many, many flares of the natural gas. So basically just being burned into the atmosphere to go after the oil. And there were several ways of moving the oil since around 2008 when it first started. One was by semi-trucks, and that was causing many problems in our community and traffic accidents, deaths. We were seeing terrible things happening as a result of using semi-trucks. And then the next thing was the trains, oil by rail. And that's when people around the country started hearing about bomb trains and all these horrible, terrible accidents that were happening, like the one in Canada where a train exploded and it killed 47 people in a community there. And so we've been fighting back against taking this oil out of the ground, which is highly volatile oil, since 2008. And now the next brainchild of the industry is this Dakota Access Pipeline to ship the oil by pipe to refineries and then, in fact, send it out of the country. So it doesn't reduce our dependence on foreign oil. It doesn't stay here where it's dug out of. But we do get left with the impacts of toxicity. And people should know that the whole pipeline route was rerouted several times. It was supposed to originally go north of Bismarck, North Dakota, the capital, and cross under the Missouri River there. But the predominantly non-Native community of Bismarck did not want that to cross north of the community. And so it was rerouted to just north of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe Reservation above Lake Oahe and the drinking source. Now, should this pipeline cross under, which they still do not have the easement to bore underneath the water, but should they get that from the Army Corps of Engineers, about 18 million people downstream are in danger of being impacted when the pipeline leaks. Because with all pipelines, it's not a matter of if, but a matter of when. So it's not just about the people here, but the 18 million people downstream, and then also eventually leading into the Gulf of Mexico.
The stakes are so high. And you talk about the response, the unification that's taking place, not only with the Sioux Nation and people, the indigenous peoples from that area, who, of course, these are their historic lands. The United States conquered those lands, but there are treaties that the United States government is bound to abide by. But now you have, this has become sort of an anchor or a magnet for indigenous people and people who believe in justice. People are coming from all over the country to where you are right now.
In fact, people are coming from all over the world to where we are right now. We've had people from Peru, New Zealand, Australia, England, you know, just all over are coming. It's been a really amazing experience because it was prophesized. A long time ago, over 200 years ago, there was medicine put in the ground in the very site that we are now camping. And during that time, over 200 years ago, it was talked about then that we would be coming together once more in unity to stand up for our rights and to stand together to make sure that we were protected. So the fact that it's happening here and now is just amazing. And I think that it just drew a lot of people because the unfortunate thing that the country started seeing was some of the violence and some of the human rights abuses that were happening to Native populations here and to people standing up to fight against water. We call ourselves water protectors, and we've been painted in the media by as being violent, as being protesters. We've completely remained in prayer. We've remained unarmed. We've remained in ceremony. And I think that's just really inspired a lot of people. 500 nations have come together to stand in unity with us as tribal people. And so others, allies, have come to stand with us because they have come to see some of the human rights abuses that have been occurring as a result of us, you know, just trying to protect the water. For example, we had, you know, Mark Ruffalo was out here and Jesse Jackson came out to stand with us. Just yesterday, Robert Kennedy Jr. came out to lend support as a president of the Waterkeepers Alliance and to talk about the necessity for clean water systems for all people. And so having our allies stand with us has been a really beautiful thing. And we appreciate it, but we have a long, long way to go. And hopefully people listening can lend their support.
Yeah. Your Dallas Goldtooth from your organization said that the purpose of the protests yesterday was to elevate the issue and to encourage the Army Corps to exert its power to stop this pipeline. Tell us about the role of the Army Corps of Engineers, why it's so crucial to exert pressure on them, and talk about, if you would, the role or the orientation of the Obama administration.
Well, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has this unique status now where they actually control the different permitting processes along the waterways, including underneath the water and a certain area right along the water shoreline. And so the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has to grant any of the easements or the permits that have to do with the waterway. And so this company, Energy Transfer Partners, started this project without ever having that permit, that critical permit, to bore underneath the Missouri River. In fact, they just called that a formality. Well, the other day, I think it was 2 days ago now, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers did put out a statement saying that they will continue not to grant the permit, recognizing the necessity to uphold, you know, certain treaty rights in talking to the tribe and in making sure that should there be a leak, there were detection systems in place. Or they even hinted, from what I read, at the possibility of a reroute for the project. And so they hold a lot of power. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers holds a lot of power. They are the only reason why this company is now at a halt at the river and not being granted that permit. Now, you talked about treaties a little bit earlier. And so I think what's really important for people to understand is that the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe signed in 1851 the Fort Laramie Treaty, and again in 1868. And so the land where we are camped, in fact, the land where the pipeline runs through and is set to cross under, is on unceded treaty territory. So if we looked at our treaty rights in this country, that land was never, ever given over to the U.S. government. So now in this day and age, in 2016, we have legal standing on talking about our treaty rights and how the government, you know, didn't uphold them in the past, but will they do that now?
We're speaking with Candy Mossett, Indigenous Environmental Network's lead organizer on the Extreme Energy and Just Transition Campaign. She's at the Standing Rock Camp protest yesterday in more than 200 cities. Amazing show of solidarity. Let's go back to the treaty rights because, you know, in the United States Constitution, a treaty once ratified by the U.S. Senate and signed into law, or signed as a treaty by the United States president, is the highest law of the land. In other words, it's not incidental, it's not ancillary. It is the highest law of the land. That means that these lands, the lands that you're standing on right now, don't really belong to this corporation or to the United States government to make unilateral decisions that could, of course, threaten the people downwater, threaten the people who live there, threaten historic burial grounds of indigenous people. In other words, it's not their land.
That's absolutely correct. And that has been the fight and that has been the battle. The tribe did file a lawsuit against the company on July 27th on those grounds, that it was never their land to determine what they were going to do in the first place, as far as building this pipeline. In fact, to date, this company has broken so many violations that it's scary to think that they're still not being charged with criminal trespass themselves. We have had over 400 water protectors, close to 500 now, that have been arrested since around August. And yet no charges have been brought against the company or the private security firms that are working with them, even though they have waved guns at us, they have put guns in our faces, they have, you know, attacked us with attack dogs, they've put pepper spray in our faces. So many different things have happened. So many of us have been arrested with charges as high as $2,000 per person for some of the felony charges that we're getting out here. And yet the company remains protected by, you know, the Morton County Sheriff's Department. They're working with private firms called GS4 and Tiger Swan. Those are tier one, military grade, high level, just back from Afghanistan and Iraq, that are here against unarmed water protectors. And so it's a really scary thing. But I think that's also why many people are coming. They're like, how can this be happening? We're going to go stand with Standing Rock. Because it's insane that they have the land, they have the rights based on their own treaties, and yet this is still happening, and people just can't really believe the injustices, and so they come and stand with us as a result of that. And so there is still a court case that's going through right now. The tribe has filed a few injunctions as a result of that court case that have led to some delays in the construction, but the company continued railroading through and have already disturbed 27 burial sites, traditional original burial sites, as a result of their continued defiance against requests by the Obama administration and by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers requesting them to halt their construction. The thing is that they consider this federal land, or not federal land, it's considered private land. The Cannonball Ranch is a private landowner sold that to Energy Transfer Partners in what we believe is an illegal land purchase. North Dakota has the North Dakota Anti-Corporate Farming Law to protect farmers from industry. But the company has 1 year to determine what they're going to do with that land, and it's only a $100,000 fine. So they're just moving forward. They're going to pay their fines and continue railroading through and bullying basically their way through, and are now bolstered by a Trump election, because Trump has stock in the Dakota Energy Transfer Pipeline, Dakota Access Pipeline, and he also received at least $100,000 from the company during his campaign.
Wow, very interesting. Very interesting. Of course, the fine on the company, $100,000, that might sound like a lot to like normal people, but it's actually nothing when you look at profits and profit margins.
That's right. It's an over $4 billion pipeline.
Yeah, let me talk to you about the influence or the impact that the demonstrations are having, the enduring camp that of resistance that you have there, the water protectors, and then the day of protest where more than 200 cities came together protesting, standing in solidarity with your struggle. In a letter to the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and the Pipeline Company, Assistant Secretary of the Army Joe Ellen Darcy talked about the history of, quote, repeated dispossessions, close quote, of the great Sioux Nation. She also said that the Army Corps of Engineers, wanted to begin talks with the tribe about potential conditions in an easement that would allow the pipeline to cross the Missouri River but lessen the risks of a spill. Could there be some kind of compromise?
I don't believe on the tribe side there will be a compromise about anything going underneath the water. The stance has always been that we will not allow it to cross underneath the Missouri River. So if you read the tribe's response, it says that some of what they said was good, but it wasn't 100% of what we wanted. And that was from Tribal Chairman David Arshambel. And so we look at the delay as a good thing, because every day we delay them is roughly $1 to $2 million. We understand from what we've been told. I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not sure exactly how accurate the figure is, but every day a delay is costing this company much money. And they've been telling their shareholders that they're going to go ahead and have this built already by this fourth quarter. So by us standing up and doing what we've done over the past 4 months and saying, no, we don't want this. You do not have rights on these treaty lands to be here. We've actually been very successful in asserting our rights as Native populations to uphold the treaty rights in the U.S. government, to look and honor our treaty rights. So what's been said by the Obama administration and what's been said by Joellen Darcy regarding upholding some of our treaty rights is pretty historic and, in our mind, a really great step in the right direction. So we're not quite there yet.
Candy Massa, let me ask you, because we have about 90 seconds left. Now you have President-elect Donald Trump. He was, of course, businessman Donald Trump, real estate mogul, billionaire, et cetera, et cetera. According to the Guardian newspaper, Trump's financial disclosure form showed, in addition to the $100,000 donation that you mentioned the company gave him, that he has between $500,000 and $1 million invested in the Energy Transfer's partner and a $500,000 to $1 million holding in Phillips 66, which will have a 25% stake in the Dakota Access Project once it's completed. It would seem that that's a conflict of interest. I mean, you have the U.S. government, the Army Corps of Engineers, trying to intercede right now because of your struggle. What do you expect with President-elect Donald Trump coming into the White House?
I don't expect a lot from Donald Trump, but I do expect the people of this country to step up and push back against injustices. Remember that he was not elected by the majority of the people in this country. He did not win the popular vote. Hillary Clinton did. And so the Electoral College has got to go. And, you know, we continue to hit them in their pocketbooks. So everybody needs to continue to divest from any banks that they have. Go to our website, sacredstonecamp.org, and see how you can divest from Wells Fargo, TD Bank, Bank of America, all of these larger banks that are funding this project, because we will hit them where it hurts the most, which is in their pocketbooks. And if we do that, then they cannot win.
Okay, well, I wish you the very best in your struggle. It's very inspiring for people here, people around the world. We've been joined from Standing Rock Camp by Candy Moss at the Indigenous Environmental Network's lead organizer on Extreme Energy and Just Transition Campaign. She was talking to us from Standing Rock Camp. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.